everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Sit Still, Look Opinionated. I'm your host, that trusty, reliable Bic lighter you've had for years, Claire Malky. Thanks for joining us. So when I was a kid, I hated soda, which shows I've been counterculture since the beginning. Soda's carbonation was just too much for me. Like that tickling, bubbling feeling on my tongue was super unsettling. If I wanted to experience the sensations of excruciating tap dancing, I would have just gone to a local dance recital. Trust me, there's nothing more miserable than a poorly executed shuffle ball change. Throughout my childhood, Soda and I would run into each other from time to time at birthday parties or school dances, but we always mutually agreed we would keep our distance. It was better for both of us if we were apart. But something changed during my freshman year of college. Soda caught my eye. After a newly befriended sophomore taught me that soda is the perfect cover for alcohol. And bam, just like that, my world was forever changed. I was instantly hooked. I felt invincible. Now, I could easily breeze past a resident assistant with my trusty bottle of Coke in hand. And little did they know that hidden within plain sight, I was holding contraband vodka. And yes, I put vodka in Coca-Cola. Give me a break. I was 18 after all. But then after a semester of drinking what tasted like a lighter fluid, I learned that all this time I had been lied to. You don't need to drink alcohol with soda. You can mix it with fruit juice or milk or even with just plain water. What the heck? I'm honestly still so offended no one told me. But I guess that's part of growing up, realizing that there's lots of shit that no one told me about. I.e. that it's 100% acceptable to drink alcohol with fruit punch. I mean, that's part of the reason I started the podcast. There was so much out there that I wanted to learn about, and I was pretty sure that other people would want to hear about what I was discovering, which kind of got me thinking about today's episode. Today, we're exploring a topic that is much more complex at its core than it appears on its surface. So, I decided to take matters into my own hands and be the counterculture gal I am and learn for myself the actual purpose of executive orders. This little piece of presidential power can really transform an administration. Want to know more about these powerful things? Well, then you'll have to stick around for the deep dive. We've got an awesome show for you all. First up, we've got our headlines, and then we'll move into today's deep dive, and we'll close out with my exciting interview with University of Virginia law student Douglas Maggs. One fun fact, by the way, Douglas is actually the second UVA grad student to grace us with their knowledge. Do you remember who the first one is? Once you figure it out, shoot us a tweet with the episode name and something you learned from that show over at Sit Still Podcast. So even though I've hated on these drinks in the past, I thought I'd give these water vodkas a try. Here goes nothing. God, that's really terrible. Grab your drink and let's get started. Up next, this week's headlines. A priceless Jacob Lawrence painting is moving to the Seattle Art Museum after residing for decades in a woman's kitchen. "We just grew apart," the woman responded. "I've moved on. Me and my Monet are very happy." The Texas governor has completely reopened the state and removed all mask mandates, to which the state doctors responded, "Sir, cattle doesn't count towards herd immunity." Despite advancements in technology, electric cars still negatively impact the environment. Automakers will slap a new coat of paint on them to make them greener. The governing party in Mexico is being roiled by allegations of sexual misconduct. Good to see everyone in the former Trump administration found work. As ocean levels continue to rise due to global warming, Miami is confident they can adapt. Proof that anything is possible with enough cocaine. Where do you think Florida Man gets all his powers? The Trump administration's White House physician reportedly harassed staff and got drunk on the job. He would have been reprimanded by HR if that wasn't part of the job description. A sole GOP congressman voted for the George Floyd police reform bill, but later stated that he pressed the wrong button. They're calling it the oopsie vote. Which is ironically the same thing the Dems are calling their women's birth control rights bill. California is looking to limit the use of NDAs. When pressed further, officials replied, "I can't talk about it right now." A new study has shown that many parents are neglecting their kids. Or something. A Californian plastic surgeon appeared in a video conference last week for a traffic violation while operating on a patient. Guess which license he lost? Both. It was both of them. A library was closed in Michigan after a poisonous spider was discovered in its basement, along with a cobweb that read, "Come at me, bro. Love, Charlotte." Disneyland is poised to reopen this spring, and you can probably guess which characters are the most thrilled about it. Get that excited look off your face, Jafar. Cruella, you too. A security guard confronted renowned poet Amanda Gorman for looking suspicious. "I panicked," he said. "She just looked like she was about to break into a sonnet or a haiku or a car." Italy's Mount Etna is actively erupting, and Iceland has felt tens of thousands of quakes that may lead to a volcanic blast. I'm going to stop right there. This is starting to sound like a sex joke. It's not. We should all be concerned for the welfare of the people in Italy and the surrounding areas. Anyway, the volcanic blast is said to cover the face of the continent. Okay, I heard it when I said it, but again, this is not a sex joke. We should just all be worried about Europe in general. Shit's gone wrong left and right for those guys. They still have their British Trump. I mean, you heard about Meghan and Harry. They got the fuck out of there. We hardcore stan Megxit. The GOP is trying to pass a bill aimed at allowing for lawsuits against social media giants. Quick, someone ask Parler for a gay wedding cake. The Pope made a historic visit to Iraq this weekend, where he hoped to deliver Psalms over Baghdad. Psalms over Baghdad! A Trump appointee, who was arrested at the Capitol, has asked a judge for a cell with no cockroaches. Sorry, Kafka. Where the moon goes, so does the nighttime. This past Monday was International Women's Day, which celebrates all the advanced rights that our husbands now let us have. Family and friends of Josh Hawley have been confused as to why the Missouri senator is all of a sudden so vocal about his conservative views. Which, that's not true. He doesn't have any friends. Fearing the Biden administration, lawmakers in Republican states are rushing to loosen gun laws. Because if there's one thing we've been missing since COVID started, it's mass shootings. And that was this week's headlines. In keeping with today's episode theme of odd powers that presidents have, we're exploring another one of those odd powers, and that is issuing presidential pardons. Even though number 45 was the latest president to abuse it to give get-out-of-jail-free cards to his wealthy friends, all presidents, in fact, have this power. For example, President Andrew Johnson pardoned every single Confederate soldier. That's a real fact. With that in mind, here at Sit Still Look Opinionated, we decided to release our own list of pardons. Because we know life is hard. It's okay to make mistakes. Just know that we love you and you're very special. Our first pardon goes to the Google Home Mini that won't connect to Spotify. It's not their fault they were poorly manufactured, but it is your fault for buying it. You pardoned. We pardoned the banana you didn't eat this week that got mushy and gross. It looked so appetizing when you first bought it, and now look what's happened. You pardoned. We pardon your roommate. It's okay they didn't take out the trash, or wash the dishes, or pay the gas bill. This time. You pardoned. But seriously, one more time and you're out on the street. I am not joking this time. It's for real. We pardon that bra you put on for the first time in a year. We know accepting support can be uncomfortable these days, especially if it's underwire. You pardoned. And finally, we ask you to pardon yourself because you're doing the best you can. You pardoned. Up next, this week's deep dive. Hi, Gabe. You're at Chipotle? Yes, I would like my usual salad with steak, black beans, mild salsa, and the salad dressing. Awesome, great. Thanks a bunch. Oh, hi, listener. I didn't see you there. It's me again, Claire, effectively the CEO of the podcast you're currently listening to. And you just witnessed me give an executive order. That's right. Today, we're diving deep into executive orders. What are they? How do they work? How have they been used in the past? What exactly makes them controversial? Do they work on children at the supermarket? I know, a lot to dive into. So let's start with the basics. According to the National Constitution Center, rated least biased and highly factual according to Media Biased Fact Check, an executive order is a directive from the president that has much of the same power as a federal law. Bam! Easy! End of episode! Heck, end of podcast! Go out on top, baby! A mic drop. Followed by a mic pick back up. Except, wait. It's not that easy. While an executive order may have the same power as a law, it is not an actual law. Which, if you ask me, just sounds like a really roundabout way of saying it isn't a law. Although if it looks like a duck and quacks like a duck, it could just be a piece of legislation. The problem is, there are no specific provisions detailing or curtailing the scope of power that is afforded to executive orders beyond the checks and balances afforded to other branches of the federal government. Like, Article 2 of the Constitution vets the president with the power to take care that the laws be faithfully executed. Whatever the fuck that means. For real, guys, it is a hotly debated subject amongst lawyers and constitutional job people who clickety-clack at their desks all day. Click-clack-moo, cows that work on the Constitution. In effect, the issuance of executive orders are the primary tool by which the executive branch fulfills its obligation to the American people. By issuing an executive order, the president is unilaterally executing a law. All other facets of the executive branch must then faithfully enact that order. This is where it's most like a law. What makes it not a law is the fact that it lacks permanence. In middle school terms, it's like a law, but not like a law. As we briefly discussed in our legislative branch episode, Season 1, Episode 5, laws can only be fully enacted by Congress. It takes a simple majority in both the House and the Senate for a bill to become a law, meaning it needs the approval of more than just one person. Similarly, it requires a two-thirds majority to repeal a law. That's what makes it so permanent. Although I would be remiss to say that it doesn't happen. After all, they did repeal prohibition, even though it took like 10 years to do so. The president can issue EOs as they see fit to execute the office of the presidency. However, that means that they, or another succeeding president, may modify or strike the EOs as they see fit. On top of that, Congress may pass legislation which overrides current active EOs, provided the president does not perform a successful veto on that bill. The Supreme Court also has precedent to determine if an executive order overreaches the scope of the president's responsibilities in faithfully executing the office, albeit with varying success of enforcement of their opinion. Or at least that's how it's supposed to work. Checks and balances, right? Except we just went through 4 years of Trump thrashing about the system like an unsupervised kid in a candy store. So at this point, checks and balances are more like the special china mom keeps in the glass cabinet. They are to be displayed, but never used. But you get the gist. An executive order is a step below a full-fledged piece of legislation. It's an active directive until it's challenged by Congress, or the court of law, or undone by the next chosen leader. But what are the main criticisms of executive orders? Well, they tend to be politicized, either because of their intended effect or thanks to the temperature of the current political climate. For example, during the Obama administration, opposition in Congress often depicted EOs as either tyranny, overstepping authority, and unlawfulness. We turn to a quote from the right-wing think tank, the Heritage Foundation. Conservatives argue that Obama used executive orders to achieve results that he failed to get through Congress, not only on immigration, but on issues such as healthcare, gun control, cybersecurity, energy, the environment, education, and gender identity, among others. These criticisms stem from the idea that a failure to pass legislation through Congress should render similar executive orders unconstitutional. However, these criticisms tend to switch sides of the aisle depending on who has power. A prominent critic of the use of executive orders, Donald Trump, quietly and quickly produced a similar number of executive orders upon taking office. Both Presidents Obama and Trump ended up issuing about the same number of executive orders. Mr. Obama with 276 over two terms, and Mr. Trump with 220 over one term. Aside from the politicization of the content of these orders, by choosing to use executive orders rather than whipping votes in Congress to pass laws, an administration can be seen as taking an easier path with lasting consequences on their legacy after no longer being in power. To better contextualize all of this, let's turn our eyes to a few examples from history. Believe it or not, executive orders are as old as our very first administration. In fact, George, no, I didn't cut down that cherry tree, Washington, issued 8 executive orders. One of those was actually to recognize Thanksgiving as a national holiday. I mean, don't get me wrong, I love having off that third Thursday in November, but let's be real. George, that holiday celebrates genocide. But hey, honestly, what's more American? Anyway, executive orders have been used by every president, except for William Henry Harrison, because he kicked the bucket a few months into office. Some presidents used a little, while others used a lot, but all in all, they gave it a good shot. Although numbering orders didn't come around until the early 1900s. That being said, executive orders really started popping off with the God of Illinois, Abraham Lincoln. He enacted executive orders during the Civil War that sealed the Union's fate. One of the most memorable being the Emancipation Proclamation. You know, the order that effectively halted the usage and trade of slaves in the U.S. Right, kinda important. Lincoln's other big move during the Civil War was suspending the writ of habeas corpus, aka constitutional right to a timely trial, aka for all you Latin nerds, show us the body. But remember how up top we mentioned that there are still checks and balances when it comes to EOs? Yeah, well, Honest Abe ran into some issues with his wartime executive orders, especially when it came to suspending habeas corpus. The executive order stated that any officer operating between Washington, D.C. and Bangor, Maine had the right to indefinitely detain anyone who got in the way of the, quote, suppression of the insurrection. It's funny how history repeats itself and apparently flies the same flag. I digress. Back to the 1860s. When a vocal Confederate sympathizer, John Merryman, was arrested and detained, he appealed to a federal circuit court for his release under the writ of habeas corpus. That court's Chief Justice, Roger B. Taney, denied the constitutionality of Lincoln's order and ruled ex parte Merryman. By the way, that's more Latin. If you couldn't guess via context clues, that means Taney sided with Merryman, which allowed Merryman to post bail, and charges against him were eventually dropped, and he was never brought to trial. This case and ruling were definitely a big blow to Lincoln's reputation. But just like Taylor Swift, he was able to shake it off. And for the rest of the war, officers arrested suspected secessionist sympathizers. Now try saying that 10 times fast. You might be thinking, well, cool, Claire, those executive orders are from like 100 years ago. Do executive orders still play a role in other parts of U.S. history? Why, dear listener, they do indeed. Some notable executive orders from the 20th century include forced relocation of Japanese Americans under Roosevelt, creation of the Office of Scientific Research and Development under Roosevelt. This facilitated the Manhattan Project and gave the world the atom bomb. Desegregation of the military under Truman, desegregation of Central High School in Little Rock, Arkansas under Eisenhower, and establishing the Peace Corps under Kennedy. Some more modern executive orders include the establishment of the Department of Homeland Security under Bush, the failed order to close Guantanamo Bay under Obama, protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the U.S., aka the immigration order under Trump, and revoking the permit for the Keystone XL pipeline under President Biden. It's also worthwhile to note that every initial military action since World War II began with the president's unilateral decision to activate and send reserve troops to combat areas. And because of that hitch, the United States has not formally declared war on any foreign nation since World War II. So, we've gotten to my favorite part of the deep dives. Why are executive orders so dang important? As our research associate, Ross, so eloquently put it, when used properly, EOs are a very effective and powerful tool. However, they are fragile by design and do not carry the full weight of enforcement as a monarch's decree. They're a hammer. When used properly, they can build strong frameworks for future legislation. When used poorly, or by someone unskilled, they tend to create future damage or weakness. And as I like to put it, they're like a Lego. When used well, you can build a strong, beautiful structure. When used poorly, it's like stepping on a nail. And that was this week's deep dive. Are you looking for a way to support this show you're listening to right now? Well, my friend, you are in luck. And not just because the Senate passed the stimulus bill. If you'd like to contribute to all the fun, you can join us over on Patreon for untethered SSLO access. If you join us on the $15 level, you may even get a shout out on the show. Thanks, Anna, you rock! But I totally understand we're in a pandemic, and if 15 buckaroos isn't your jam, you can always join us at the $3 level. We'd be happy to have you no matter what. Now, you may be asking, but Claire, what other levels are there? And that is for me to know and you to find out. Hey, I can't give away all the surprises. Where's the fun in that? For real, if you do want to check us out, you can give us a visit at patreon.com/sitstill. Up next, my interview with University of Virginia law student, Douglas Maggs. So for today's interview, we have my good friend, Douglas Maggs. He is a law student at the University of Virginia based in Charlottesville. Douglas, thank you so much for being on the show.
Claire, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm super excited to talk about executive orders and learn a little bit more about their intricacies. So before we get into the interview, could you tell me a little bit about your background and a little bit about yourself?
Yeah. So as you mentioned, I'm currently in law school at the University of Virginia. But I like to say that my interest in law and pursuing a legal career has been very deep-seated and long-standing. I have a number of lawyers in my family, including a few law professors, and I joke that I started learning constitutional law at the dinner table at about age 5. So I would say that I don't mean to put myself out as any special expert, but I certainly have been studying this material for a while, and I'm eager to talk about it. I actually studied classics and history in undergrad and for a master's degree, but my interest in those fields is related to my legal interest in that I have long looked at systems of governance and governmental management, be it in ancient Rome or in other more modern societies. So I'm eager to talk to you today a little bit about executive orders, the unique role that they play and the unique spot that they fill in our particular country's constitution and governmental framework.
Amazing. Wonderful. Yeah, I am doing a little bit of research. I've been wondering about our executive orders. Do they have a basis in other forms of government as well, or are they purely an American experience?
Yeah, so I think that there's definitely bases for executive orders elsewhere. An interesting thing about executive orders that I think it's important to realize, though, is that even in our own Constitution, nowhere do the words "the president may issue executive orders," that's not spelled out in any specific terms. So our Constitution, as I'm sure you and our listeners know, has the three branches of government divided up. Article 1 assigns powers and duties to our legislative branch. Article 2, powers and duties to our executive branch. And Article 3, powers and duties to our judicial branch. So executive orders, obviously, we're talking about the president and the president's power. And so immediately you'd want to look in Article 2 of the Constitution. Article 2 establishes for us pretty clearly that there's one chief executive, the president of the United States. But like I said, there is not this specific permission stated in as many words for the president to issue an executive order. Rather, there's the far more generic provision that the president can essentially take those actions necessary to fulfill his role. And so essentially, the executive order is something that has existed from the beginning of our democracy, from the first days after the Constitution was ratified, but it is a ability, a function of the executive that is in many ways subject to interpretation. And I think this is something that we see in other governmental systems as well, that any place throughout history, be it in some of our common law predecessors in England, or even in some of the Roman systems of governance, whenever you have a strong executive leader, they have some sort of broad authority to issue a statement or issue a directive to get something done. So I would say that executive orders is sort of a more modern construct of a term, but at its most basic premise, it's just one facet of that chief executive in whatever society's government we're talking about, one facet of that executive's ability to fulfill their duties.
Wonderful. And for our listeners, if you want to learn more about those three branches of government, you can check out our episodes from season one. We break those all down. So if you want a refresher, go back and check those out. So since executive orders are part of a breakdown, part of the executive branch, are they exactly laws or do they function a little differently than laws?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the simple answer is that they are not laws. And the reason is because the president doesn't have the power to make laws. That is a power that Article 1 affords to the legislature. In our system, when you want to create a law, a member of Congress brings a bill up. It's considered by both houses of Congress. And if both houses of Congress ultimately approve it, subject to whatever revisions and reconciliations there might be, then that bill can be transmitted to the president's desk, where the president can either sign it, if he or she signs it, it becomes law, or if he or she vetoes it, it can be kicked back to Congress, and vetoes can be overridden with a two-thirds majority. But fundamentally, yeah, laws have to come, at least at the federal level, have to originate in Congress. So an executive order is definitely not a law. But one reason that they often get lumped in with laws is because they function sort of similarly for all intents and purposes. Basically, when the president issues an executive order, that order can be something very minor, clarifying some policy, establishing some role that, you know, somebody that the president thinks is going to help them get their job done better. So, you know, a recent one that we have, for example, is that President Biden issued an executive order establishing an official pandemic task force chair position, essentially. But then these executive orders can also be far broader. You can have things like, and just to suggest a few sort of famous examples from history, President Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, which freed all of the enslaved African Americans in the South at the beginning of 1863 in the heart of the Civil War, that was an executive order. Similarly, as a more recent example, President Trump's travel ban, Muslim ban, as some people referred to it, that was an executive order. And so you see that these executive orders can really have a wide variety of potential implications and powers, but they're not absolute. Of course, it sounds a little bit too good to be true, right? That, you know, oh, if the president can just issue this executive order, then suddenly, you know, what's the purpose of Congress, you know, passing laws? If Congress says, hey, we're not going to pass some law that the president wants passed, this is sort of a great backdoor route. Well, the thing is that checks and balances in the government apply to executive orders much like they would to laws. What do I mean by that? Well, a president needs to ground his executive order in one of a couple of justifications. So one way that a president can authorize, can say, hey, I'm allowed to issue this executive order, is by citing to his constitutional prerogative. So, you know, in the case of, you know, President Truman integrating the troops during his presidency, he said, as the commander in chief, I'm authorized to manage our military and make decisions about how our military is going to operate. In the case of, you know, President Trump's travel restriction, travel ban, he said, well, you know, there's this essentially this law, the Immigration Nationality Act, which gives me broad authority to act according to what I view as national security interests. And so essentially, these executive orders, they need to have some basis in the Constitution or basis in existing statutes, in our existing laws, for the president to be able to issue them. Well, what happens if the president issues something that maybe, you know, is controversial or not everyone agrees that it has that basis in law or in the Constitution? Well, you can file a suit. You can argue that it was an unconstitutional or unjustified act. And judicial review, which is the third branch, the one we've talked about the least so far, the courts, they can take a look at an executive order and they can say, yeah, this was constitutional, or no, this wasn't constitutional. If a court says that an executive order was unconstitutional or was not grounded properly in statute, it is null and void, much like how the Supreme Court can strike down a law or a portion of a law if it finds it to be unconstitutional. So that's the check that the judicial branch has on these executive orders. And the legislative branch has a check on them as well. If the legislature does not like an executive order that has been passed by the president, fully validly, constitutionally, let's say, they can pass a law that changes the legality or the status of that executive order. So, for example, you know, if a president issues a great example is the Paris Climate Accord. You know, President Obama entered into that via executive order. President Trump left it via executive order. President Biden reentered it via executive order. Well, what if Congress, given Congress, felt differently than the sitting president about whether or not the country should be in? Congress could, in theory, attempt to pass a law that says this, you know, the United States will or will not be in the Paris Climate Accord. And of course, that law itself is potentially subject to legal challenges. It might be found to be outside of congressional legislative power. But if it was not, and Congress successfully passed it, then, you know, poof, that's another way that your executive order goes away. So they are immediate and they look a lot like laws, they're not absolute and they're not some magic backdoor solution for a president to accomplish what they're trying to do, because there are still these checks on them.
Those checks and balances are always interesting to find in government and seeing how everything can be balanced out. With that example with the Paris Climate Accord that you just mentioned about Obama entering it, Trump leaving it, and then Biden re-entering it, do executive orders create long-term change, or are they sort of a quick fix in some senses?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. It really can depend. I think that an executive order certainly has the capacity to create long-term change, in that if a president issues an executive order and it takes effect and functions as if it was law, essentially, or rather, you know, similarly to how a law would function, then, you know, hey, that's the law, that's the policy of the land. The thing about them, though, is that you do see this ability for presidents to say, hey, we're in, no, we're out, no, we're back in. And I think that's what you always have to remember, is that our presidents serve for a relatively short period of time. One presidential term is only 4 years, and we have a limitation that any given president can only serve can only be elected to two full terms. The chances that all of your future successor presidents are going to agree with everything that you did via executive order, statistically, it's kind of low. You know, I mean, we have a two-party system, and especially in recent years, we've seen a lot of back and forth. I think for the last five or so presidencies, it's gone from Democrat to Republican, back to, you know, Democrat and so forth. And so I think that in terms of long-term change, anytime you're issuing an executive order, yeah, it's probably in the back of your mind that it would only take your predecessor wanting to go down a different path to change it from day one, much as President Trump did to Obama's entry to Paris Climate, much as President Biden did to Trump's exit from Paris Climate. And then the other thing about it is, I think that long-term change it's also relative, you know, because our country, in the scheme of things, how old are we? You know, a little over 250 years. So what is long term? Mm-hmm. If some law is around or some executive order has been existing for 50 years, that's a fifth of our country's existence. That kind of sounds substantial. On the other hand, many, many, many people alive today, in fact, probably the majority of Americans have been alive for, 50 years. And do we necessarily think that that makes them incredibly old? Well, maybe not. So I think that sort of long-term is a little bit relative. And then the other thing I would say on this point too, is that we've increasingly been seeing very closely divided Senates and houses in recent years. Actually, the present Congress is a great example. You have a Senate which is split 50-50 right down the middle. That's obviously created some interesting opportunities for the vice president to potentially break some of those ties. And even in the House, you see a majority, but the Democratic majority is single-digit seats out of 400-plus seats. When you have such slim margins, one thing that's often going to happen is that it's that much harder for the leaders of a given party in Congress to corral every single one of their members to fall into rank and vote for some particular piece of legislation. So I think that when you have a closely divided Congress, there's probably extra temptation for a president to issue executive orders, because it's a way to get something done when, if Congress is in gridlock, it may just be very, very difficult to pass any remarkable legislation. And the thing about an executive order is that it takes effect immediately. And yes, there may be legal challenges. It may ultimately be struck down. There could even be stays preventing it from coming into effect. But fundamentally, when the president issues the executive order, the contents of that order happens immediately. When Trump issued his travel ban went into effect immediately. Now, it was actually stayed pretty quickly after by a federal judge, then went through a variety of legal challenges and ultimately concluded with the Supreme Court deciding that a later iteration of it was constitutional, was allowable. But given that that was something that I would think, and I think most people would agree with me, that it would have been very difficult for President Trump to get through Congress, it's a way to try and enact a piece of change that that he sees, you know, a reason to enact right away. Same thing with the climate accord. You know, are you going to get every single member of a given party to support entering it or exiting it? Maybe, but it's a pretty tall ask.
Yeah, that is definitely very, I can see how that would happen, especially since the Congress and Senate are quite large and there are a lot of members. It could be very difficult to have everyone be on the same page about something. So with gridlock and those things that you were just speaking on, are there any controversies around the idea of executive order, or is it something that has been established that people come to accept as a part of the presidency?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there always are going to be objections to exercise of executive power, or really exercise of any kind of power. Frequently, you'll see people object if a president who's not of the same party does something that they don't like. That'll bring out a lot of objections. But there certainly are scholars who will just question more generally whether this executive order power, which again is really just the ability of the president to issue a directive to get the job of the chief executive done, has it grown to sort of this outsized monster, you know, that the framers maybe never intended it to be. And I think that's an interesting argument. I don't necessarily know that there's a simple answer to it. I think that looking to history, one thing that's pretty interesting is that all presidents from George Washington to present, to Biden, have issued executive orders. One exception, William Henry Harrison served as our president for only 31 days until he died. I don't think he ever got one out, but I imagine if he had served a bit longer, he probably would have. So I think it's a fair characterization that executive mm-hmm. orders have been around since the beginning and straight through. But they were certainly a lot less formal in early times. Indeed, nowadays, executive orders will be codified with a very particular number as an example of sort of a well-known executive order. One of the most controversial and pretty much universally detested executive orders was one that President Roosevelt issued during World War II, Executive Order 9066, which basically was a directive for Japanese Americans and other immigrant American of certain nationalities to be placed in these relocation or essentially concentration camps. And so you'll hear executive orders mm-hmm. talked about by numbers. You know, that's 9066. Other more recent ones, the Muslim ban was, I think, like 13780, for example. But basically, the point is that when George Washington issued an executive order, or when Abraham Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation, like we spoke about before, that didn't get assigned a formal number. Actually, this numbering convention didn't come into effect until the early 1900s, I think it was under President Teddy Roosevelt, and they started about number 5,000. That was sort of an estimation saying, hey, there's probably been about 5,000 of those that have been issued so far by preceding presidents. And, you know, the interesting thing is that now and again, someone will be digging, some archivist or scholar will be digging through old documents, and they'll find something that kind of looks like an executive order from the presidential papers of some, you know, early, you know, like first 10 or 15 presidents. And, you know, it's sort of an interesting question then of, you know, executive orders, if they're not specifically repealed or overruled by future law or found unconstitutional, they may still be valid. So, you know, you wonder what did some, you know, relatively lesser discussed president, you know, I wonder like what, you know, what executive order did James Buchanan leave for us that might still be in effect today, technically. But anyways,
yeah,
we're today at about executive order number 14,000. I think that we just crossed that threshold last month, actually. And so that gives you a sense of how many have been passed since the sort of more formal number and record keeping started in the early 1900s. You know, when there's thousands upon thousands of these being issued, I think that it's a pretty difficult argument for someone to say that executive orders are flat out unconstitutional or flat out unacceptable. But like I alluded to before, I definitely think it's the case that the more controversial, the more divisive, the more political an executive order's content may be, the more people may cry foul on the side of the minority party, or the party not in the White House, I should say.
Mm-hmm. That definitely makes sense. I mean, there's always going to be opposition to whoever is in power, and that's why we have the two-party system. So we are in, you know, the first 100 days. This episode will release during the first 100 days. Why do we tend to see a lot of executive orders during this, you know, primed time, I guess, of a new president?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that the single biggest reason is because, you know, a candidate runs on all these various promises that, you know, hey, when I'm, you know, in control, you know, when I'm sitting there in the Oval Office, everything's going to be different from how it was. That's how you get voters to the poll. You know, you say, whatever it is that my predecessor did, I'm going to do something totally different. Or if you're an incumbent, you say, all the things I have been doing, more of the same is going to keep on happening. And executive orders are a great way for a president to chart the course right at the beginning of their presidency and say, here are the kinds of things that this presidency is going to be all about, that I'm going to prioritize. And as we spoke about before, it's just an efficient way to get things done. I mean, you know, 100 days goes by very quickly. I'd be amazed if you could, you know, get very many bills at all to even be considered by both houses of Congress in just a 100-day span, you know, what with all the corrections and the reconciliations and everything else. Meanwhile, executive orders, if you have a pen and a desk, you're good to go. Start signing them. And yes, you know, there may be some challenges that come along to them. And so I think this is something that we've seen pretty commonly from recent presidents that, and this also goes back to the fact that it has been frequently the case that we're switching from Democrat to Republican, Republican to Democrat. So there's probably a lot of more prominent political issues that a brand new president is very eager to change. I'm pretty sure that in his campaigning, now President Biden said several times that, you know, a day one objective of his presidency was going to be rejoining Paris Climate. And he did. You know, he issued an executive order on January 20th, just an hour after the inauguration concluded. And so I think it's a way to sending a lot of executive orders out right away is a way to demonstrate to your voters that you're serious about the issues that you ran on and that you're really trying to affect the change that that you said that you were going to. But one other thing I think is interesting to note is that executive orders, I actually think that they are probably more prominent now, sort of in the public eye, than they might have been in the past. And I've actually read a few articles that I think don't quite get it right. They suggest that executive orders are being used more than ever. That's actually not accurate. The presidents that used the most or issued the most executive orders are some of the ones that are a little further back in history. I've got some numbers here for you. Far and away, the leader of executive orders is Franklin Roosevelt. He issued over 3,700 of them. Immediately after him, President Truman, he issued 907. So, you know, a respectable number. But however, in recent years, we actually have not seen anyone since Truman crack 500. And indeed, some of the other presidents of recent years have issued far fewer. So I thought this was pretty remarkable. Bill Clinton, 364, George W. Bush, 291, Barack Obama, 276, Donald Trump, 220. And so I think it's really interesting that people talk about how executive orders have this huge influence these days. And I don't mean to deny that that is the case. I certainly agree that it is. However, I think that executive orders are in the public eye because of a handful of blockbuster executive orders, not because of a massive, massive use of the power more generally. In other words, you know, you only need to issue 10, 15 blockbuster, highly political, highly controversial executive orders to be labeled a president that heavily used the executive order power, you know, and the number of sort of more minor, more backseat, you know, more functional ones, or functional is the wrong word, but more just sort of, you know, perfunctory ones, that seems to have less bearing. And of course, you do have to think about the fact that, you know, President Obama was a two-term president. He issued 276. President Trump got 220 out in just one term. So that's definitely a higher rate. But, you know, even if President Trump had a second term, he'd still be, you know, at 440, which, again, that just, it really does pale in comparison to Truman, to Roosevelt and to some of those other presidents from a little bit back in our history.
That declining statistic is so interesting, how it's been steadily decreasing over time. But I wonder, you know, just pondering here, if, you know, with the rise of social media, that, you know, only one or two executive orders that are these big blockbusters are the ones that stick in our mind, whereas there's, you know, at least 100 other ones. That's so thought-provoking of the times, I guess.
Absolutely. And I think it's also just indicative, too, that I think we are seeing people becoming more and more engaged with their government, which I think is fantastic. That, sort of the functionings of our government, that shouldn't be something that's just relegated to a high school civic class for, you know, each American child. And then it's sort of, you know, forgotten, but for the handful of people that go into politics or go into law or go into related fields, this is a government, for the people and by the people. And we are in a situation where all 300 plus million Americans kind of know something about the functioning of the government. So I think that has been really interesting to see politicians, using social media being a place for sort of your average citizen, to sort of really weigh in and potentially get a pretty big audience to sort of say, hey, we like this executive order, or on the flip side, we don't like this executive order. So yeah, I absolutely agree with you. I think it's very interesting and definitely a sign of the times that executive orders are one of those pieces of government that people are thinking about perhaps more, the general public is thinking about perhaps more than they were, 40, 50 years ago. Although I, of course, wasn't around then, so I can't say for sure what people were or weren't talking about then.
So true. Douglas, this has been a wonderful interview. If our listeners want to learn a little bit more about executive orders or do their own research, where would you direct them?
Yeah, absolutely. A couple of suggestions. So the first thing I'd say is that executive orders are all carefully cataloged. Like I said, they're all publicly available in the Federal Register. And so you can go online and access them, take a look, and maybe as a little challenge to the listeners, go and find out what's the number and the content of the most recent, executive order that, President Biden has signed as of the moment that you're listening to this tape. I'd also highly recommend taking a look at the American Presidency Project. It's an outfit run from UC Santa Barbara, really fantastic, nonpartisan, just informational service that can teach, I think, a lot of really great material about sort of the executive branch, the duties of the president, sort of the day-to-day operations of really all sorts of presidential powers. So I'd highly check that out, highly recommend checking that out, the American Presidency Project. And then I'll also just give a brief shout out to one of our esteemed professors here at the University of Virginia School of Law. Professor Sai Prakash is an expert on executive powers, which obviously includes executive orders, among many, many other very interesting issues. He has a few new books out in the last couple of years, as well as a myriad array of journal articles. I think that Professor Prakash has some very insightful thoughts on executive power, and I'd highly encourage people to take a look at his work.
Wonderful. We'll be sure to put those in the show notes so everyone can check those out. Well, Douglas, thank you so much again for being on Sit Still, Look Opinionated. We really appreciate your time.
Claire, thanks again for having me. It was really great to be here, and I really appreciate the opportunity to chat with you today.
And that's all for today. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can email us at sitstilllookopinionated@gmail.com. And make sure to follow us on Instagram at sitstill_lookopinionated. And now on Twitter at sitstillpodcast. And make sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. And if you didn't hear that right, please write a review. Please, please, please write a review! This podcast was produced by Michael Dritto and Claire Malky, and written by myself, Claire Malky, Michael Dritto, Fee Basanyavichis, and Gabriel Scavor. Theme music by Terrence Jackson. Transition music by Christina Walter. Research by Ross Black. This program is partially supported by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council Agency. If you would like to support this podcast, please visit and subscribe to our Patreon page linked in the show notes. This podcast was recorded on the land of the Kickapoo, Peoria, and Potawatomi Nations. And of course, I'm your host, Claire Malky. Oh, and don't forget, stay opinionated. Bye.